think China knows this, and so they're just trying to lawyer up, as it were, in the South China Sea to prepare for that eventuality.
China boosts nuclear weapons. It's Tuesday, January 11th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, registering Afghan refugees, a high-stakes diplomacy meeting, a top tennis player clears a COVID hurdle, capturing carbon, feeding the needy. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Experts who follow developments in China say it will bolster its nuclear weapons arsenal in the years ahead, mainly to match the United States. Fu Kong, Director General of Arms Control at the Chinese Foreign Ministry, told reporters Beijing will continue to modernize its nuclear arsenal for reliability and safety issues. The Pentagon had warned less than 2 years ago about China's nuclear capability after learning that Beijing was building 110 more missile silos. Scholars studying the issue say signs of nuclear weapons growth in a country that seldom discusses its military developments means Beijing hopes at least to show its arsenal can resist that of Washington, if not catch up. Alexander Vuving, professor at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii, says China has no other major rivals, as its relations with nuclear power Russia are improving.
I think China knows this, and so they're just trying to lawyer up, as it were, in the South China Sea to prepare for that eventuality.
An atomic bomb test in 1964 got China started with nuclear weapons. The U.S. Defense Department, in an annual report to Congress, says as of 2020, the country was developing new intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, that would significantly improve its nuclear-capable missile forces. The Pentagon report says the number of warheads on land-based ICBMs capable of threatening the United States is expected to reach about 200 over the next 5 years. Beijing had previously maintained just 20 or so silo-based ICBMs, according to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. A mobile ground-launch intermediate-range ballistic missile system that could swap conventional and nuclear warheads is expanding as well, according to the Pentagon report. The U.S. nuclear arsenal totaled 3,750 warheads as of 2020. Since 2017, 711 U.S. nuclear warheads have been dismantled. At its peak during the Cold War, the stockpile totaled around 31,000, according to the State Department in an October news release. The department called for increasing the transparency of states' nuclear stockpiles as part of their nonproliferation and disarmament efforts. Washington still leads Beijing in the development of the world's deadliest type of weaponry, according to experts. More nuclear weapons authorized by Beijing would reflect a wider U.S.-China arms race, says Eduardo Arrual, associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School. He adds weaker countries in Asia may chafe, but should not feel surprised.
Has to befit China's status as a rising power. Once they have it, then I think it will start to create regional attention. People will start to take a jab at the law itself and see what are implications that they can derive when it comes to maritime disputes.
China and four other permanent UN Security Council members, a group known as the P5, said Monday they would work together to stop the further spread of nuclear arms and avoid nuclear conflict. Officials in Beijing have maintained over the years that their nuclear weapons are for national security only, not for an offensive strike. Scott Harold, a Washington-based senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation Research Group, says China might use nuclear weapons, however, if the United States threatens to overwhelm it with tactical weapons in a real conflict. He adds Chinese President Xi Jinping may want better nuclear weapons as part of his bigger plans for China. Harold and other observers say nuclear weapons will further help Beijing discourage any attacks on its territory and perhaps get what it wants during Sino-foreign diplomatic negotiations. The feeling also is other Asian countries, including Indonesia, the Philippines, and Malaysia, are modernizing their militaries, partly so they can keep up diplomatically at the bargaining table with China. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings for sharing this story, and you may read more on our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. City near China's Winter Olympics site has Omicron outbreak. Xinjiang paramilitary anti-terror cop to lead Hong Kong garrison. Indonesia may allow coal export resumption as early as today. India turns to boosters as it battles another COVID-19 surge. Baby lost in chaos of Afghanistan airlift found and returned to family. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more at Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Pakistan has concluded a month-long campaign to register Afghan refugees and issue them identity cards that will protect and safeguard their interests. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The government-run campaign, supported by the UN Refugee Agency, began in mid-April. The registration drive has updated the data of some 1.4 million Afghan refugees. This is the first large-scale effort to verify the status of refugees in Pakistan in the last 10 years. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says the refugees are given so-called smart identity cards that legitimize their status and facilitate their access to humanitarian aid and other benefits.
The new identity cards are an essential protection tool for Afghan refugees and give them the faster and safer access to health and education facilities and to financial services as well. This drive also provided an opportunity for Afghan refugees to flag any specific protection needs for vulnerabilities.
The UNHCR reports more than 300,000 Afghans have fled to Pakistan since the Taliban took over their country in August. Their situation is precarious, as most have entered the country illegally and may be liable for deportation. The United Nations warns Afghanistan is becoming one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. It notes 24.4 million people, more than half of the population, need life-saving humanitarian assistance. It says more than 9 million Afghans are displaced within the country, with little prospect of returning soon to the homes they fled. Baluch says more than 40 verification sites were set up across Pakistan during the registration drive last year. He says mobile registration vans sought out Afghan refugees living in remote areas. He says a mass information campaign also was carried out to explain the purpose of the campaign to Afghan refugees. He says this effort has paid off with large numbers participating.
Among them, there were 200,000 children under the age of 5 who were registered by their refugee parents. More than 700,000 new smart identity cards have also been issued to date. The remaining cards will be printed and distributed in early 2022. These cards are valid until 30th of June 2023.
Baluch says the campaign is part of a wider effort to assist and protect Afghan refugees. Gathering more detailed information about the refugees, he says, will enable the government and aid agencies to better tailor assistance to them. In addition, he says, it will facilitate support for those refugees who decide to return home when conditions in Afghanistan allow. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, a high-stakes meeting. Happening now in Asia, a court in Myanmar sentenced ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 more years in prison Monday after finding her guilty of illegally importing and possessing walkie-talkies and violating coronavirus restrictions, according to a legal official. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. U.S. and Russian officials are meeting this week to address the tensions along the Russian-Ukrainian border. It has implications for Asia, as Michelle Quinn reports.
The tense situation in Ukraine, with as many as 100,000 Russian troops near the Russian-Ukrainian border, will be the topic of discussion this week in Geneva, as U.S. and Russian officials meet. The situation, which has been brewing for years, escalated in recent weeks with the troop buildup. Russia has denied it plans to invade its neighbor and demanded that NATO forces pull back from Eastern Europe as part of security guarantees. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said there is room for negotiation. Reducing American troops in the region is not on the table, but he said other issues are, such as reviving a treaty that placed mutual limits on where troops can be deployed and conduct exercises. Blinken, however, added there would likely be no breakthroughs in the first talks, given what is happening on the ground.
To make actual progress, it's very hard to see that happening when there's an ongoing escalation, when Russia has a gun to the head of Ukraine with 100,000 troops near its borders, the possibility of doubling that on very short order.
Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Rybkov, told Russian news agency Sunday that there might not be much progress in the talks because the United States lacks an understanding of Russia's security concerns. Since Russia crossed Ukraine's border and annexed Crimea 8 years ago, tensions between Moscow and Kyiv have been high. Ukraine is a former Soviet republic. While a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine called on the U.S. to send more troops to the Eastern European nation, Republican Senator Mike Rounds said he supports the Biden administration's efforts to find a diplomatic solution with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I think sending a message to Mr. Putin that he's going to get a lot more accomplished using diplomatic means rather than threatening to invade is something that we should be very, very firm about.
Secretary Blinken said there are principles bigger than Ukraine in play, such as not allowing one nation to change borders by force or to subjugate its neighbors.
That's why it's so important that we stand not only for Ukraine's territorial integrity, its sovereignty, its independence, but for these basic principles.
After officials meet in Geneva, they are expected to continue talks this week in Brussels and Vienna. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia, Nepal has begun vaccinating school children for the coronavirus as the country sees an uptick in new cases for the first time since October. The government announced the closing down of schools until January 29th and proposed a ban on gatherings of more than 25 people in public spaces. Find more on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, world number one tennis player Novak Djokovic has won his case against deportation from Australia on the country's strict COVID-19 vaccination rules. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Novak Djokovic's fans celebrated Monday outside an immigration hotel in Melbourne where he'd been detained. Federal Court Judge Anthony Kelly said the Australian government's decision to cancel his visa was unreasonable. He said that the Serbian tennis star wasn't given enough time to speak with tournament organisers or his legal advisers after he was detained Wednesday at Melbourne Airport, a standard treatment for an unlawful non-citizen according to Australian law. He'd flown to Australia believing he had an exemption from the country's COVID-19 vaccination regulations, which state all foreign nationals entering the country must be fully inoculated or have a medical waiver. Djokovic said he'd contracted coronavirus in December, which gave him the right to apply for an exemption. However, Australian border authorities had said that the tennis star had not met immigration regulations and would be deported. But his lawyers told the court that the decision to revoke his visa was illogical, irrational, and legally unreasonable. Immigration lawyer John Finlay told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it was a hard case for the government to win.
This is the outcome I expected, yes. Mr. Djokovic's lawyers put a very compelling case. The main thing that the court was concerned about was the unfairness, the manifest unfairness to Mr. Djokovic about the way the officers at Melbourne Airport conducted themselves.
Djokovic has been released from detention and will likely be allowed to defend his Australian Open title. He's won the event 9 times. Should he triumph at this year's tournament, he'll become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
While Djokovic has cleared this hurdle, there is another wrinkle in the story, as we hear from Craig Gabriel, who is reporting from courtside in Australia.
Controversy often follows Novak Djokovic, but it's never been like this before. And talk about dramatic. A judge has overturned the decision to cancel his visa, some may say on a technicality, and ordered the authorities to hand over his passport and belongings, and he was allowed to leave detention. But the matter might not be over. While the court case was between Djokovic and the Home Affairs Minister, his visa can still be cancelled by the Immigration Minister, and that has already been flagged. As a minister, he has that personal power. Now, if that happens, Djokovic will be deported and will not be allowed to re-enter Australia for 3 years, and it could have further ramifications for travel plans to other places, as many visa applications ask if you've been denied a visa or been deported. The government appears to possibly not be convinced that the information provided for him to get a medical exemption to enter Australia was totally legitimate. Djokovic is regarded as an anti-vaxxer, and a medical exemption was the only other way he could get into Australia to play the Australian Open. The court of public opinion was not happy he was given the exemption, especially when he applied for it before he supposedly tested positive for COVID a second time, which he never disclosed. A vast contrast to when he got it the first time 18 months ago. He was also pictured with kids, maskless and not social distancing, and handing out trophies. In Australia, there's a saying, it just doesn't pass the pub test. Craig Gabriel, VOA Sports, Sydney.
Making headlines in Asia, thousands of people were left homeless after a fire gutted parts of a Rohingya camp in Bangladesh. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The blaze hit Camp 16 in Cox's Bazar, a border district where more than 1 million Rohingya refugees live. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Iceland is now the home of the world's largest direct air capture and storage plant of carbon dioxide. The plant aims to remove from the air each year 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide, one of the main contributors to global warming, as VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The world's largest plant capturing carbon dioxide directly from the air is now operating in Iceland. The plant was built by Climeworks, a Swiss firm, using technology from another Icelandic company.
With a capacity of 4,000 tons of CO2 that are captured from the air every year, so that's the nominal capacity, and we are then handing over this CO2 to our partners from Carbfixed, who inject it underground, and the CO2 there is mineralized with the basalt rock, and it's turned into stone, literally.
Filters in huge fans in the plant, called Orca, have been set up to do the job. Chemical engineer Natalie Casas is ClimWorks head of research and design.
We have this box where we have a filter material inside. The filter material has a high affinity to CO2. This means when we blow air through the collector, the CO2 sticks to the filter material, and we keep on blowing air through. When the filter material is saturated, we stop, we close the box, and we start heating. We heat with low-grade heat up to approximately 100 degrees. And while doing so, the CO2 is released from the filter material and can be pumped out of the collector.
The heating process to create the high-grade carbon dioxide that is then pumped deep into basalt caverns requires energy. Casas says this comes from a nearby geothermal power plant, a renewable energy source.
So we don't want to emit CO2 while capturing CO2. We also did a quite thorough LCA, so life cycle analysis, in order to understand how much CO2 are we emitting while capturing CO2. And the plant we have in Iceland, So its efficiency is higher than 90%.
ClimWorks says building direct capture plants are not enough to solve the whole global warming problem. Countries will need to remove 1 billion tons of CO2 from the atmosphere by 2025 to meet Paris Climate Agreement target goals and avert catastrophic warming, according to a recent study. The International Energy Agency says there are currently 15 direct air capture plants operating worldwide, removing more than 9,000 tons of CO2 from the atmosphere per year. The Energy Agency says global CO2 emissions last year totaled just over 31 billion tons. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Celebrity chef and TV personality Bren Herrera and her family take the idea of giving very seriously during the holidays and the rest of the year. Maxim Moskalkov has the story.
700 homeless people and others in need in the Washington area received free hot meals on Christmas Day. It's the sixth year in a row celebrity chef and TV personality Bren Herrera, together with her family, held the charity event called Bren Plus Friends.
So the point of Bren and Friends right now is not only to serve the community, but also to let the people who need food, shelter, don't have family, don't have friends, don't have that connection. We want to let them know that we see them, that we value them, that they are not alone, and that they are loved, no matter what their circumstances, financially or otherwise.
Herrera was just a child when her parents started making home-cooked meals for homeless persons in the Washington area back in the late 1980s.
When you consider that we came from Cuba and we're very intimately aware of what food disparity looks like, what food deserts look like, what rationed food looks like in that system, it's almost inherent for me to know and understand that we have to do something for the people.
Herrera's initiative has become more and more ambitious every year. Instead of one park, volunteers now serve food at three different locations and distribute donated winter clothes. This year they managed to feed 100 more people than last year.
We do it every year for the past 6 years, so I've had a lot of good memories from serving people. Memorable ones being, I think 2 or 3 years ago, I have a skate group that started assisting, and as we're a lot more mobile, especially during the pandemic, last year was pretty challenging because there weren't a lot of people in parks like we were used to. So teaming up with the skate group made it easy to actually deliver to people that weren't in specific parks.
This year's menu consisted of smoked chicken, meatballs, fried potatoes, green bean casserole, and traditional turkey stuffing.
So these are basic roast potatoes. So we're actually doing roast potatoes with salt, pepper, a little chicken stock. Going to broil it in the oven, get a brown on it, and then refrigerate it for tomorrow, then heat it up for a serving.
Herrera's helpers are mostly members of her family and friends, as well as people she has known for a long time.
It's been a few years, ever since she picked it back up. And I've known Brent for probably close to 10 years.
Herrera says her goal is to create a foundation that would serve the communities throughout the year. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Continue with us online. You'll find us at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. We thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Keith Lane, Chris Cascajo, and Jessica Stone. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead. Be safe. Be well.